don't call me a seaweed or
seaweed, right? I interviewed a lady named Shruti last week, and a friend of mine keeps calling her Shootri because he can't get the syllables in the right order. Okay, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2. Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of interviews with spiritually awakening people. I've been doing this for about 6 years now, a little more, and there are hundreds of them archived. If you go to batgap.com, you'll find them on all categorized in various ways under the past interviews menu. This show is made possible by the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So thanks to those who've been supporting it. And if you feel like making a contribution, there's a PayPal button on the site. And it's made freely available to anybody who wants to watch it. There's no obligation or anything in order to watch it. So my guest today is Jürgen Zieber. Jürgen lives in the UK, originally from Germany, and he's a fascinating fellow. You began meditating, Jürgen, in 1969, right?
Yeah.
Was it TM or some other form of meditation?
I started with TM.
I had a feeling you did, because you know, everybody was learning TM in those days.
Yes, that's right. That was sort of thing that was available at the time.
And you mentioned that in 1973 you did a six-month course of some sort. That those were also offered in the TM movement. Was that within the TM movement?
That wasn't a course. It was just me being totally dedicated to lock myself in my room and not get out until I had a long sort of session of meditation behind me.
Ah.
I was very keen to reach the apex.
Yeah. That's a... Hopefully that went well for you. That can be a little dangerous for people sometimes, you know, if they're not prepared for that.
It went wrong, actually. Yes.
Did it? Yeah, you mentioned in your bio that there were some negative side effects.
Yes, I mean, the thing was, until then I read a lot of books, and I read about enlightenment. I had no idea what it was all about. I didn't even know what to expect, but I thought I needed to know, I need to have the experience everybody's writing about in these books I read and talking about, and I thought that is a very desirable goal. So I started meditating on the light, on mantras, on the TM mantra, on all sorts of things. And I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I meditated till about 9, and then I went to college. Then I sometimes came back in the evening, meditated, and I did this for about 6 months. But in the meantime, I noticed I became really aggressive, frustrated. I had bad experiences, and I thought it had the absolute opposite effect of what I was hoping for.
Yeah. Do you understand now why that was happening?
Yes, I think I actually did get into some quite dark areas. And one of the signs was, and I haven't really talked much about it in the past, I was painting at the time because I was an art student. And at the time I was trying to deal with my inner demons and my fears and all sorts of things. And I started doing a painting of some demons. I literally did a representational painting of demons. And I became very fascinated. Mm. And the more I became fascinated, the more I was drawn into this sort of almost dark art. And my meditation went into that sort of direction because all sorts of anxieties came out. And then one night, I went, settled down to meditation, and I found the painting I had finished fell off the easel, and an ashtray at the time I was still smoking was catapulted right across the room with all the fag ends strewn across the floor. And I suddenly experienced an incredible chill. And you have to bear in mind, I didn't believe in anything supernatural at that time. To me, anything supernatural, that was just sort of superstition. But when I came into the room, there were no windows open. It was very chilly. The painting was on the floor and the ashtray on the opposite end of the room, which was sort of 4 meters from where I left it. And then I experienced this fear And then I didn't know how to deal with the fear, and I was quite scared. So I found a book by Krishnamurti on the bookshelf, and I opened it randomly, and there was a chapter on fear. And as I read that, I suddenly had a sense of clarity, you know. And after that, I decided the whole thing is bonkers, and I'd rather be where I was before I started meditation, and just not have anything to do with it. So I was quite happy with the decision, because that meant I could go back to my old hedonist student days, you know, I have parties, do all the things I really enjoyed, and sort of turned my back completely to the whole idea of enlightenment, of meditation and so on. And then that went on for some time, and I was getting more into the stride of being myself. But then something happened, and that was a crucial thing, because outside my student flat where I live, there was on Wednesdays at a market. And I always went to the same place. They had a beautiful fresh rye bread, which I bought, and some very strong Tilsiter cheese. And I made it a habit on Wednesday, I would have a really sort of nice breakfast. So I cut a big chunk of my fresh bread, layered a big, so half inch slice of cheddar cheese, brewed a very strong cup of coffee, and then I started munching into this breakfast. And suddenly, as I was holding my fat sandwich, I lost my relationship with my sandwich. I couldn't figure out who was actually holding it. And then as I was looking at my hands, I suddenly thought, who do these hands belong to? And I couldn't, I lost all connection with my body and the reality I was in. And then suddenly the most extraordinary thing happened. I lost any sense of identity, and I didn't know who I was. And instead, I was suddenly, the whole light, the whole room turned into a blinding light, and I was totally disembodied, and I entered into the space of, the only way I can describe it is clarity. Everything became clear and sharp, but to such an extent that I was just not able to find anything I could compare it with. It was just an absolute clarity, and it was really absolute. There was nothing, no further I could go, and this incredible light sort of filled everything, and I suddenly realized that is the essence of what I am. You know, there's nothing before and nothing behind, and that's just it. And it's almost impossible to describe. The only attributes, I couldn't find any attributes that I could give to it, and the only attributes I could find was sort of neutrality. There was no bias, no for, no against. It had no attributes whatsoever. It was just absolutely clear. And that was not the only thing. The moment I entered into this space, I was overcome by waves of ecstasy. And they were almost painful, you know, as if I was stripping sort of layers of any false ideas or anything other than this clear light, as if it was sort of stripped off me in very quick succession. And the more it was stripped, the more ecstasy I felt, you know, until I was totally succumbed by it. And I remained in this space for, I can't remember how long, but quite some time. And then I was overcome by incredible waves of love. And I felt that was a moment when I was returning to some sort of sense of normality. And the interesting thing was, when this happened, it was a bright summer day, and it was quite bright, but it failed when my senses returned, as if I was returning into the middle of the night. It felt so dark, you know. And then, as soon as I got my heap of flesh together again, I sort of fell into. I was overcome with incredible emotion, you know. And I went into a crying session, you know. For no reason other than that my body was trying to deal with what had happened. And then gradually I became normal, but not quite, because I was in a state of a peace. I couldn't even express what it was. It was just a complete stillness. There was nothing moving, and I got out of my room, and it was as if I had arrived for the first time on this planet. And everything was new. Everything felt as if it's, I've never seen it before. It was as if I've been on this earth for the first time, as if I had descended into an alien world. And it was incredibly peaceful and beautiful, and there was a radiation coming from everything I saw, which gave me a sense of belonging, you know. So this went on for some time. I didn't know what to say to anybody. I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I just quietly walked around with this sense and tried to get my head around the art school. But I just went to art school. I listened to the lectures and I went home again. I was just not able to participate. Then fortunately, in a way, this gradually faded, and and I came back to normal. But then some months later, I started having these spontaneous out-of-body experiences. Mm-hmm. And the first one was one which I wasn't prepared for at all, because I was lying in my bed. That happened before, this tremendous experience happened just before I got married. And then and I was still on my own in my student accommodation. And then after we got married, we moved to another town, and then I had the first out-of-body experience, which was a total dislocation from the place I was. I went to sleep, or I was asleep, and suddenly I was wide awake in front of my parent, my mother's house. And there was no doubt about it that this was a real, the real thing. I felt I was physically there. The only difference was I had a 360 degree vision, so I could see all around me. And the other curious thing was, I didn't have a body, you know, and the body sort of reluctantly appeared when I wanted to have a body, you know. So I materialized, and then as soon my first panic thought was, what is happening here, you know, what's going on, how do I get back? I was quite sure that I shouldn't have been here. And this pulled me back into my body, and I woke up my wife and I told her what has happened, and she just said, go back to sleep, that was evening, and so on. So that was the beginning of it all, and then I became curious. There was no literature. I went to the library trying to find out whether I had a brain seizure or a problem, you know, a physical problem. And eventually I came across a book section which dealt with parapsychology, and I wasn't really interested at all in this subject. But there was a mention of a kind of doppelganger phenomena, and I thought maybe that was it. And then somebody gave me a book of Castaneda, which was called A Separate Reality, where he actually in great detail described what I had experienced. So that to me was the clue to start seriously get interested in it. And then we moved to England, and as soon as we had moved, and I sort of lost my came into a new environment, I started having spontaneous out-of-body experiences from then on, which happened almost on a first on a sort of weekly basis, you know, and quite often somewhere very short. But I became, as I started taking an interest in them and reading books about it, I was able to control them more. So that was the start of the journey, if you like.
Yeah, great. Would these out-of-body experiences happen while you were doing things, like driving your car or walking down the street, or were they more when you were in a meditative kind of state?
Yes, I mean, they happened usually when I went into, when I was in a meditation state. Mm-hmm. My meditation completely changed after I had this experience. I didn't do any TM or anything like that. It was just a kind of devotional practice, you know, where I focused on a sense of gratitude, if you like, mm-hmm. you know, which was more sort of heart related, you know.
Gratitude to whom?
Gratitude to what I had experienced, in a way. This experience was sitting with me. From day one, it happened. It never went away. It was as if somebody put up a lighthouse in my life, and it was always there. And I knew it was there. I knew that was a beacon. And later, when I totally lost my way, in a way, because I was bringing up a family and having a career, and I was more focused on very materialistic things, I still had the knowledge of this otherness, you know. And the best way I can describe it was that it's never left me. It was, the word I found for it was, I refer to it as a silent companion, an aspect of beingness, which was with me all the time and which I could rely on in lots of ways, but it didn't have it was like a presence. It was, the best way I can describe it, it was as if somebody was walking around with me all the time.
But you eventually discovered that it wasn't someone other than you, it was your own inner silence that you were sensing.
Yes.
Yeah.
That didn't happen until much later. Mm-hmm. That actually happened in 2013 when I went on to a meditation retreat. Until then, I always referred to this, my silent companion, and the silent companion did actually make appearances in deep states of meditation, and one in particular, where I entered a spontaneous state of samadhi, where this presence was accompanying me in this state. That was shortly after I came out of hospital in 2011. That was a very powerful experience, which I also documented in my latest book. And then in 2013, I went to into a solitary retreat in the Scottish mountains in a little mountain hut by myself, and I was deliberately meditating and keeping a record of the meditations. And then after 4 or 5 days, the best way to describe it is like a recall experience. You know, I don't even know whether it's an awakening experience. It was a recall experience where I felt what I really was, and I had forgotten, you know, all my life I had sort of forgotten really that I was that thing. And then that was a moment the silent companion merged with me. That was a moment where I felt this otherness, or this entity which was very, very closely related to me, was actually who I was. And it was nothing more like a recall. And this made me feel that that is what everybody actually has at the root of their being, you know. It made me feel that I wasn't anything special. I was just in a state where I could remember my authentic self.
Yeah.
And everything before then was just a smoke screen.
You know, sometimes in the traditional literature, enlightenment or awakening is referred to as a sort of remembrance or a recall kind of thing. At the very end of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says to Lord Krishna, "I have regained my memory," essentially of who I am. So it's precedented, this sort of thing.
Yeah, this is how it felt. You know, I didn't have the same experience I had the first time. I have to say, all these experiences which come up in state of samadhi or deep meditation, they all, each meditation, each experience is completely different. You know, I found, and it's infinite. I think the type of experiences you can have, and this one was quite different. It was preceded by a meditation the previous day where I was faced with an abyss of reality. You know, I sunk into a state of depersonalization where I could not, similar to the one I had the first time, but this time I fell into an abyss of reality, you know, which became increasingly real and more real and more real, and I felt increasingly threatened by this reality, and I felt if I go too far, there can only be God, you know, and I was afraid of this enormity I was about to be faced with, and all my life I wanted it, but now I was at the threshold, I was incredibly scared of it. I thought, if I go a step further, I will lose everything, you know, and I just can't, and it was too terrifying, and it put everything into question. So that was a meditation I had in the morning, and I felt I just needed to go a step further, and the only way I can do that is to allow this incredible, fearsome entity, which could only have been God, to obliterate me completely, you know, and then there would be nothing left of me, and it was terrifying. So I then almost prayed to get my ego back. So I went back and I tried to reassemble my identification, and I took my camera out, I took photographs and tried to fix some sort of arbitrary identity which I could deal with, which I could control, which was the darkness of myself, and that suddenly felt the desirable thing, you know, to be and to enter into again, and I didn't feel I was ready for this thing. Now, at the same time, of course, I felt like a great coward, you know, because I've been meditating for 40 years. And when it came to the crunch, I didn't have the guts or whatever was needed to take the step into the abyss, you know. And before, I was often told or shown that you really need courage and fearlessness. If you want to walk this path, you have to lose fear. And I felt I had lost all my fear. You know, I lost my fear when I was diagnosed with cancer, and I realized I was not afraid, you know, because in fact, I was elated in a perverse sort of way. And the fact that I wasn't afraid anymore of something which was quite serious, made me feel as if I had conquered fear, okay? And I was not afraid of death or dying and so on. And then that went away. I came out of hospital. I had another very incredible experience, which I wrote in Vistas of Infinity, which was my silent companion calling me into this meditation. But this time, when I was in Scotland, and I went back, I went into the abyss, I had this fear, and the fear controlled me. And then the next day, I spent the rest of the day regretting, basically, that I failed, you know, after spending all my life aiming in a way for this to happen, or wanting this to happen. And then the next day, I started meditating, and in the end, I wrote a book about it because I kept a journal all for the whole week. I journaled every thing I went through it, and the book was called the 10-minute moment, because that is what, yeah, that's what it was all about. And the next day, I started off very gently. It was a very beautiful day. I felt an incredible love, and it was almost as if during the night something was stripped away from me, you know, and I was free. I felt really free, and I felt good, and the meditations went really well. And then I sat in front of my hut, and I looked at the landscape, and I felt this incredible peace and stillness, and it was beautiful, an incredible contentment. And then suddenly I noticed this, what I thought was the sun falling on the grass. And it lit the grass up, and I thought, how beautiful, you know, what a beautiful light this is. And suddenly I realized the light sort of was cascading and laying like mist all over the landscape outside my hut. And then I noticed that it wasn't the sunlight. I could see everything burning from within. I could see it as energy. And this spread out, it came out towards me. And as I looked down on myself, I noticed my body was made out of light. And this trivial thought came into my head, which made me think, oh, I must be enlightened. And then I had this incredible experience, which I referred to earlier. And this was so powerful. I couldn't even bring myself to find words for it. I had the experience of infinite pain as well as infinite pleasure. And the two things were just combined into one. And I noticed by looking at my watch that only lasted about 10 minutes, the experience, but it was totally overwhelming, you know. And that was it. After that, I felt the sense of separation that totally disappeared. And there was no way I could get it back, you know. And when I wrote the book, which was 9 months later, published it, I noticed that was still the case. And I couldn't imagine how I could get this alienation back, you know. It was just not happening, to the extent that I can't even remember who I was yesterday. You know, there's no persona I can assemble around this awareness, which I could claim to be me, you know. So this has disappeared now, and now it's 3 years later, and what I'm finding is it is a very, very natural state of being, and I'm very convinced, very, very convinced that that's what we all really are, and everybody is that. And for some unknown reason, we are not having the recall. We are not having the memory that connects us to our true identity.
When you say this has disappeared now, what has disappeared?
Well, this sort of sense of that I am something other than a person. Or an identification with something personal, you know. I'm an illustrator, for example, yeah. You know, commercial illustrator. All these identifications which I thought I am, which build up the persona we think we are, all this sort of is irrelevant. It doesn't have any meaning. It doesn't carry any weight anymore. So if people were to refer to me and say to me, oh, you're a really bad illustrator or something, I wouldn't know how to identify with that, you know. So that's basically what's happening, because it's more a matter of seeing a bigger picture, living in a beingness. It's the only way I can describe it. It's always there.
So would it be fair to say that, you know, for all those years, and we'll talk about the intervening years later in this interview, but for all those years where you had all those experiences and out-of-body things and lucid dreaming and all that stuff, there was still very much an identification, a sense of I am having these experiences.
Yes.
Whereas this thing you just talked about, the identification dropped off. In fact, the day before that, it was like, I am afraid. I don't want to let go of who I am or what I am, and yeah. God is too much. He'll gobble me up. But then once you had relaxed into that transition the next day, the sense of I dropped off, and identification or definitions of yourself as anything other than being or presence dropped off, and simply haven't returned over the past several years.
Yes, that's the state now, and that's what I find is actually the norm, the ground state of human beingness.
Yeah.
I find I arrived at the point in a way where I can safely say I'm human.
And so this whole thing that you just described, even though you described it in the past tense, this happened to me this day, and then the next day this happened, it's an ongoing thing. It's not really past tense. It's just your natural state of living now.
Yes, that's it. You know, I have to say the whole episode in between that happened with my out-of-body experience, they were actually quite relevant, I find, in my training, and I didn't discover how relevant they were until I wrote the book, you know, because one of my daughters asked me, when I had several diaries sort of filled up, she asked what they were, and I said they're my out-of-body experiences, and she said, oh, I'd quite like to read it, you know, why don't you type it all out? So I thought, yeah, that'd make a good. And that was the first time I started reading them again. When I started typing them, I realized over the years there was an inner programming going on, an inner teaching. And I literally had a teacher who appeared during my out-of-body experiences who was training me because I didn't belong to any sort of yoga school or anything like that. And this teacher he was a Chinese master, he appeared in my out-of-body experiences, and he trained me. He for 6 months, he sort of groomed me.
Let's set the stage a little bit, because, you know, we haven't really talked about your out-of-body experiences, but you're alluding to them. But after that first one you had during sleep, where you were in front of your mother's house, you then went on to have decades worth of out-of-body experiences, hundreds and hundreds of hours if you add them all up, and all kinds of amazing, clear experiences of all sorts of dimensions and realms and all, you know, after death realms and all kinds of things that were going on, even hell realms. Just this went on for years and years and years and years. So I've interviewed a couple of people who talk about out of body experiences, but it's not even though it's kind of everybody knows the term and it's kind of commonly understood. For some reason, it hasn't been too common on this show, perhaps because. I'm just guessing, but maybe people who are interested in out-of-body experiences aren't really interested in enlightenment as their main priority or as their main goal. They just want to have interesting experiences. Do you think that might be true?
I don't know. I've belonged to a Facebook group it's called Astral Travelers, and people who are regular people there, I find they're very spiritual people.
I'm sure they are, but how is it, you know, if you think of astral travel, it's sort of like, okay, my body's going to stay here, and my subtle body is going to go there. But how does that relate to self-realization, which is not a matter of separating subtle body from gross body, but really a matter of discovering something much more fundamental than either, and, yeah, and living in from that foundation.
The main strength I've found is the fact, is a very profound realization that you are not the physical body.
Mm-hmm. So it really drives that home.
Yes. So that is one experience most of the people who are call themselves out-of-body experiencers share. They have all made the fundamental experience that they no longer see themselves identified with a physical body. And that, I think, is a very, very vital step on the path, and that can be very good.
But do they go on to identify with the subtle body?
Yeah, so that's when I started having experiences of higher dimensions, and I mean, it's a bit like in the Theosophy, where they divide the realms of consciousness up, you know, into the astral, the mental, and the spiritual regions. And of course, these can be experienced. And what I did is basically, I started, when I had out-of-body experiences, I started using them for meditation. Mm-hmm. So instead of meditating in my chair, I was sitting in my astral body, in my astral chair, and I was meditating. And this is a very, very powerful experience, because it's a bit like launching a rocket from space, where it doesn't have to overcome the gravity. Okay, so it doesn't burn any fuel. So basically, thoughts become instant reality. And the first discovery I made was that if I use a mantra Om during this meditation sessions in my out of body state, it would immediately catapult me into higher states of consciousness. You know, and this is one thing which I, you know, explained to the group, and people have confirmed that when they do astral travel and they use the Om meditation, they immediately get into a higher elevated state of consciousness. And that has sort of this has a little bit caught on and spread. And many astral travelers now use that, because you have to bear in mind, out-of-body experience can become really boring if once you get used to it, in a sense, because you are limited by your imagination, you are limited by who you are, you know, and this is what happened to me. I felt I reached a ceiling, you know, I met these incredible places and these wonderful people and these astral realms, but I felt I was limited. And whenever I tried to go higher, I literally hit a ceiling. And this, I'm not the only one who has experienced this. I read about Robert Monroe, who was an out-of-body experiencer, who wrote a book, Journeys Out of the Body, one of the first pioneers. He came across the ceiling phenomena himself. When I reached the ceiling, it was literally like a plastered ceiling, you know, ornamented ceiling. I used to punch my way through it in order to get to a higher level. Everything takes on a very symbolic meaning, and the symbolism becomes actually physically real. Because when you are in an out-of-body state, but the environment appears to be as physical as our environment here, you know, but it's on a different level, really. You know, so you work just as hard to get through a ceiling as you would work here. And I literally ripped the plaster off the ceiling in order to get through the next level. And I figured that was the way the mind understood that I had a desire to break through. So the symbolism actually became a reality, okay? And you could work with these to go through other levels. It's quite difficult to explain, but these are tricks which you can use in order to achieve higher levels. But the most important thing is it has to be accompanied with the right kind of feeling. If the feeling isn't there, then nothing really happens. And in 1980, I had this series of breaking through ceilings, which ultimately that was after I had this training by my inner master, this Chinese guy I mentioned in my first book, that he helped me then to break through the ultimate ceiling, and that then in this out-of-body state, I again reached the state of clarity, okay, but by a completely different route. The first one was a spontaneous experience. The second one was an inner experience, an inner journey, where I went through non-physical realities, which felt just as physical as a reality here now. But the consciousness expanded, and the realities, the realms, became increasingly more glorious and more strange and more fascinating. And in the last level, I was accompanied into the state of clarity again. But this time, the way I experienced it was that I was standing at the shore of an infinite ocean of light. And there were waves of light crashing in. And it felt just like standing on the beach, but everything was made out of light. And each wave which crashed in on me triggered an ecstasy, until I went through a series of ecstasy, and then I entered the state of clarity again, which was indistinguishable from the first experience, the same state, you know. And then the third time was in Scotland, which broke the camel's back, so to speak. And then it was unmistakable that that is now the status quo. That is what human beings are. That's what we are really. Everything else is an illusion, you know.
Yeah, that leads into a question. Some people will remember Ramana Maharshi saying that, and many others, I'm sure, saying that anything which comes and goes is not the reality. You know, there's that saying in the Gita, the unreal has no being, the real never ceases to be. And therefore, one should not seek after experiences which come and go. One should, you know, make one's priority the realization of that which always is, which never comes and goes. So there's so many points I want to discuss with you, but let's discuss that one for a minute, because, you know, there are a lot of people who study Vedanta and read Ramana Maharshi, and they might be thinking of thinking what you just said, which is all these levels are ultimately an illusion, and they might be wondering, well, why bother with them then if they're ultimately, why not just skip right to that which never comes or goes, which always is?
Yes, I've thought about this a lot, but I think there's basically people have individual paths, you know, and I think my path is I'm an artist, you know, I'm a very visual, experiential person. When I connect, even before I consider the outside world as anything spiritual, I connected with it from a visual, emotional point of view, you know, as an artist, you know. And my inner experiences sort of reflected that. And I felt there was a natural attraction to explore the inner worlds in much the same way as I explored the physical world, you know. So I felt that there was a attraction along this path, and a fascination, because the worlds I discovered in there were incredibly rich and beautiful and fascinating. Of course, they were not any spiritual realization. They were more like a world of enhanced entertainment, if you like, you know. But I, especially in my second book, I started using these as a communication of consciousness, as teaching, consciousness teaching me. So I took these very seriously, and whenever I had a question, very often consciousness would draw me into an out-of-body state where I found the answer. You know, and they said, I mean, they start from very trivial questions. When I was asked to do an illustration about medieval knights, and I wondered what did they look like? You know, I wonder whether they are right when I looked at the reference books. So the next night, I had an out of body experience where I found myself on the battlefield of medieval knights, and I was totally conscious, and I studied the seam of the dress, what color it was, you know, how they rode the horses. And I was just looking and taking all the detail in. And then I went back and, you know, I had a clear picture of what it was like, you know. And of course, there were plenty of occasions where I used these information, which people refer to as the Akashic records or things, where you can glean all sorts of information. And sometimes they are only, you know, a thought away. You know, for example, I mentioned that before on my website, in my book. I was illustrating a book on deep space, and the editor asked me to supply an illustration of the Big Bang. And I asked him, what did it look like? And he said, how should I know? You are the artist, you know, nobody knows, nobody was there, you know. And I thought, I can't possibly do an illustration of something that I don't know what it looks like, you know. So the following night I had an out-of-body experience, and I called, take me to the Big Bang.
Interesting.
And no sooner had I said that, when I was suspended in a black void. But I didn't see a big bang. I saw, or I heard, four sounds. And these sounds were sort of feeding back on each other. Okay. And that was it. And then I went back, and then I figured, okay, there was no big bang, there were four sounds, but what may have happened is there was a feedback mechanism. You know, like when you hold a microphone in front of a speaker, the feedback mechanism results in a big bang. And I went to phone up my editor and I said, ah, what about if the big bang was initiated by four sounds and there was a feedback mechanism and it exploded and it caused the big bang? And he said, no, you know, it wasn't like that. Just draw a picture of a big bang, you know, how you imagine it. So that was the story. But I found after that, it is actually possible to glean information during an out-of-body state. And there's literally no limit to the information you can access, because what we're dealing with is a universal mind. And we are just separating off a small section of the universal mind, which we call our own, you know, and we can get experiences. But this sort of entering the Akashic mind or the universal mind, we have unlimited potential if we wanted to, you know. Yeah. But of course, there was never really enough time to follow, or not even the interest to follow it in detail. So later, after 2008, I decided, I take note of, I wasn't really interested in out-of-body experiences. I was more interested in meditation, you know, and reaching a state of stillness, you know. But when they happened, I saw them as invitations by the greater consciousness to draw my attention to certain aspects. And one aspect I was drawn to was to be familiarized with certain aspect of the non-physical reality, because there was so much ignorance about it and so much speculation. And I started taking notes. And therefore I wrote the book, Vistas of Infinity, you know, how to enjoy life when you're dead, basically, because it was a cross-section of what realities we are likely to find when we die. And I found this is an important work, because people, when we have nobody has got a clue of what's going to happen. We're all sitting on the train and not knowing where the station is and when the train will arrive. And then there's a big blank screen and nobody knows. There's only speculation and beliefs. And some of the beliefs I've come across are quite wrong, really, in my experience, you know. And some beliefs are devastating, you know, to humanity, to
Sure.
civilization.
I mean, there's people who believe that when you die, that's it. You know, you're snuffed out like a candle. And there are spiritual people who believe that, actually. I've interviewed a number of people who say, well, there is no reincarnation because there is no person, ultimately. And so if there's no person, how could there be reincarnation? Because for the, you know, there would have to be somebody to reincarnate, some kind of kernel of individuality that goes on from body to body, life to life. And I think they're wrong, as I'm sure you do. But I just want to make a statement here to help kind of help put things in context, and that, and see if you agree with it. And that is that what you have been doing all of, most of your life, all these explorations, is obviously not incompatible with enlightenment or realization, because that has dawned for you. And so all of this was not a trap or an impediment, you know, or a distraction. It was, in, for you at least, conducive to the realization that eventually happened. I think maybe it can be a trap and a distraction and impediment for some people. They can get overly infatuated and distract, you know, absorbed in it, and spend a lot of time just sort of fooling around, you know, with woo-woo experiences and not getting right down to the core of things. So maybe there's that caution. But I don't think it has to be an all-or-nothing proposition the way some people would suggest.
Yeah.
You know, and there are people who are keen on Vedanta who would just dismiss all of this discussion as irrelevant and you know, superficial and just, you know, a failure to go right to the heart of things. But you have to remember that, you know, Vedanta means the end of the Veda. So if you respect Vedanta, maybe you respect the whole tradition of which it is the end. And that tradition includes consideration of all kinds of possibilities and relative phenomena and subtle realms and higher states and astrology and, you know, health considerations and everything under the sun, is because life is multidimensional and life contains so many different things. You know, even if you're enlightened, you still have a body, and that body probably needs food and it needs support, and then. You know, once enlightenment has dawned, or even before it has, there is still the relative creation, is there not? And I mean, and there can be value in acquiring knowledge of its various aspects. I mean, there can be specific knowledge. I mean, maybe you're a scientist or a doctor, and there's a lot of knowledge you need, or a jet pilot or whatever. There's a lot of things you need to know and skills you need to acquire there, whether you're enlightened or not. But then there's, you know, in a more spiritual context, there's a huge, vast realm of possibilities that humanity in general is unaware of and unappreciative of, which may actually have tremendous benefit for humanity if we were aware of it and if we understood it better. And so enlightenment or awakening can be a platform on which that exploration can take place, and we as a species can kind of grow up and become much more profoundly appreciative of the beauty and diversity and subtlety of God's creation. So anyway, that's my little rant.
I think I agree with every word you just said, because, I mean, dismissing this is like dismissing life, you know, dismissing creation. We can't dismiss it because it's an intricate part of creation. You know, because I also found these experiences tremendously educational, you know, on all different kinds of levels. And one thing I find throughout all these experiences, we haven't even scratched the very surface of our human potential. It strikes me that we are sort of barely risen from the Stone Age, that our evolution hasn't even really begun as a human species.
Yeah. So just to interrupt one more time, then I'll let you go again. Would you agree then that, you know, spiritual development or evolution or enlightenment or whatever we want to call it, ideally might consist not merely I say merely, of self-realization. I mean, self-realization is ordinarily considered a pretty big deal, and you don't usually associate the word mirror with it. But not merely of that, but that could become a sort of a starter point or a foundation upon which all kinds of amazing possibilities for human development might be explored and unfolded. And that those might have huge implications for us, not only individually in the way we experience our life, but collectively, societally, in terms of what the quality of society could aspire to and rise to, and technologies, and you know, I mean, look at all the suffering in the world for various reasons, and you know that suffering is very real for the people who are undergoing it. And personally, I feel that spiritual realization is the ultimate antidote to that suffering, and it might include more than just, you know, self-realization. It might also include the discovery and application of a vast range of latent capabilities that that are going to be much easier to unlock if the self has been realized.
Yes, I never really could get my head around the idea of Buddha's teaching, for example, that you want to escape into nirvana or something like that. You know, I never really could embrace it because I cannot really separate the two, the creation. And when people say, oh, once you're enlightened, you never have to come back, I personally don't see that as an issue living in the whole of creation, all the realities. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to restrict myself to living in this physical place or in that physical place or anywhere else, or be a poor person or a rich person. I can live in the whole spectrum of consciousness, which is literally infinite.
And I've heard it suggested that the desire to not come back was perhaps the product of a society in which, you know, a tooth infection could kill you, in which there were, you know, the quality of life was pretty brutal in some cases, and you think, I want to just get out of here and never come back.
Yeah, I think this is probably the case, that the philosophy rose out of this understanding that people wanted to literally disappear from the possibility of ever having to suffer the physical hardships ever again, you know. But once you reach the true understanding of what reality is, it doesn't necessarily remove the pain from your life on the conflicts, but it does put it on a completely new perspective. So we actually have something we can work with and deal with, and which will inspire us to achieve a greater evolution, you know, and become a conscious part of the evolutionary process, because we are part of nature.
Yeah.
And once we become a conscious part of this evolutionary process, it opens all kinds of doors for us. I mean, I've been in these higher states of consciousness where I saw evolution taking place right at the primary stage, where it was dealing with geometric shapes, the things starting to appear in a very abstract way, you know. And then as soon as attention was focused from whichever angle, it crystallized into manifestation. And the manifestation process was so infinite and so beautiful. There were universes created on the fly, and they disappeared again, okay? In front of my very eyes, I could see how this huge creation process was unrolling and evolving and retreating, and even people had the power to manifest things and pull it back, and this enormous infinite variety of what is possible was there for everybody to experience. And the thing is that once you become aware of all this, of the mechanics of creation, suddenly, you know, enormous opportunities become visible on the horizon.
Yeah.
And an understanding of how the world is put together and how it works, how our psyche functions, you know, because everything we do, everything we are, is basically nature growing and unfolding, even if it's insanity. It's just nature at work, doing its thing, you know. And the way I noticed how thoughts unfold and how thoughts are created is basically we're following a natural program. You know, we don't do anything unusual. We're just using the same mechanics nature at the highest level uses in order to manifest. They're using it to manifest thoughts and spin ideas and ideologies. Mm. You know? So we are very much part of nature. We just haven't realized it yet.
Yeah, there's something that relates to this and it also relates to the point we're just making about not wanting to come back again. It seems to me that the attitude of not wanting to come back again is oriented around a kind of a rigid sense of oneself as an individuality. I, this individuality, don't like this and I don't want to come back again. Whereas, you know, a broader, deeper perspective would be after having been gobbled up by God, so to speak, which was the reference you made earlier, that if you felt like you're about to be gobbled up, then you function and regard yourself more as an instrument of the divine, you know? And there's more of a sense of service and surrender and use me as you will. Whether I come back or not is not a big deal to me. I'm happy to be an instrument in whatever way I can be.
Yes, because you're no longer so identified with a certain set of issues, you know, profession or anything like that. You're no longer identified with anything. You're just a being state.
Yeah.
You know, you're just, there's nothing really to achieve or to do other than expressing of what you are, you know, and expressing yourself as joy. And from the state of being, and this is why I find it so beautiful, because to explore our inner worlds, because there is so much potential we don't know anything about. We are just like robots. We are programmed by instincts and drives and traumas and experiences, and we have no control over these. You know, because they're just happening in some dark realm, and yet we are doing things to each other and having opinions and likes and dislikes without having the slightest knowledge of where these come from, how they're generated. But when we move consciously into the subconscious realm, we suddenly see everything in a multimedia presentation, which we can deal with, which we can handle. You know, we can see the monsters which are haunting us. We can confront the monsters. We can pose questions. We can find answers, you know. To us, I mean, this is only a very recent discovery, which started this invention of psychology, you know. Now we can actually, with lucid dreaming, and there are quite a few psychologies who use it as a gateway to an inner understanding of what we really are. We can use these inner worlds, you know, to actually function better as human beings. Mm. At the moment, we are just groping around in the dark. And a lot of things I found is when people do have the experiences, they very quickly jump to conclusions, because they have an experience, and then they think, oh, that's it. They enter a greater state of consciousness, and suddenly more things become visible, and they see the light, and they immediately think, oh, yes, I know, I've got the truth now, I know what's like. And they go out and preach their truth, you know, and before you know, you've got a new version of a religion or a cult or something, you know, and that happens quite often, rather than seeing that what they only have got from the whole of infinity was a minuscule fraction, you know, of a diamond which has got infinite facets, you know, and suddenly this, the attention is drawn towards this, and suddenly it becomes a big thing. One of the things is, for example, near-death experiences. They find themselves very often in a state of bliss and even cosmic consciousness, or that's how they would describe it. And then they come back and they feel they have got the whole picture, you know. And that is also an illusion. You don't ever get the whole picture because the universe is infinite. For example, some people say, I was attacked once when I, you know, because of what I wrote. You know, when you die, you don't automatically go into heaven or something like that.
And people, you wrote that.
Yes,
like you might go into hell or something, right?
The whole book is based about the continuation of the reality you foster during your waking life. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's no miracle taking place that suddenly catapults you into heaven or into hell or whatever. It's just a natural chain of events. It's a process of nature unfolding. And just because your physical body disappears doesn't make you a different person.
Right.
So you carry over what you are, and you are still dealing with it, you know. And what happens when people have suffered a near-death experience is quite often they are catapulted into a higher state of consciousness, which allows whatever forces there are to administer some form of healing.
Healing. You
know? Yeah. And I think that's very often the case. They get catapulted out of the limitations of the physical and emotional situation, and they suddenly find themselves in a state of clarity. But then they come back, okay, and then they have this awakening experience, and then it would be wrong for them to claim that when you die, you immediately come into the presence of God and all is forgiven. You know, that's not, in my experience, at least that's not how I experienced it.
Yeah, yeah. So they may claim that because they had something of that nature in their experience, but it's not necessarily going to be the universal experience.
No, that's the reality is the reality. I mean, there's no getting away from it. If you start claiming that when you die, you get into heaven straight away, then you open the doors for people like ISIS to do whatever the hell they like.
Sure. Yeah.
In this life, because they know they're going to be safe. But in reality, psychology kicks in, and the mechanism, which is a very physical mechanism, works its way out so that people do actually are confronted with the energies they have set into motion. You know, and there's no getting away from it, because where should these energies go? You know, you are so attached to this energy like a magnet, and you will draw them towards you, you know, and you have to work with them. So the idea that when a person dies and people say, oh, he has peace now, he rests in peace, is a big illusion. Reality just doesn't work like that, and people may find that objectionable to make statements like that, because everybody is hoping when they die they are released from their misery. No, you have to still keep working, you know, and you're still on your path. And okay, you've got new opportunities. And what I'm saying is based on hundreds of, you know, hours of experience where I interviewed people, where I talked to them, where I met my brother, my mother, and talked in great detail, which I wrote documented in my book. So even after all this, I still feel I've barely scratched the surface of what is actually happening, you know. But it needs to be, we need to address these things in order to free ourselves of these false ideas and these false illusions, you know.
I agree. I mean, if you look at old maps from like when Columbus first came, or, you know, early explorers, and you look at maps of what they thought North America looked like, it's sort of funny. I mean, it's all distorted and weird, and they had no idea what was in the middle of the country or, you know, any place else. And even Lewis and Clark, when they went across in the country in the mid-1800s, they had no idea what they were going to encounter and some of the mountain ranges they were going to have to go over and stuff. And, you know, these days with satellites and all, we have everything mapped out right down to the centimeter practically. We know precisely where everything is, and exactly the whole topography is clear. So if we use that allegory or that metaphor to talk about the deeper realities of the universe, there's a certain value in having things mapped out if you're going to try to travel to California. And like that, there's a value in understanding how the universe works, it seems to me, as a human being, and when you die, and if you're interested in enlightenment, and all kinds of things. So I think it would be really interesting and useful, and perhaps will happen over the years, if as a culture we map out the whole territory of all the realms and dimensions and subtle realities, and actually if enough people have the experiences, so that we begin to get a kind of an agreement between various explorers, and you know, I can imagine there must be cultures somewhere in this universe who have actually done that and who have as much clarity with regard to all the whole subtle range of life as we have with regard to the geography of North America.
Yes, I think that's actually one project which we have discussed on the forums.
Uh-huh.
We collectively should sort of collect all the experiences and just record them. And unfortunately, this project never really got off the ground.
Yeah.
But it would have been an enormous research tool for people, you know, for explorers to find where there is a common ground, you know, what are common experiences.
Yeah. So from your own experience, having done all the exploring you've done, if you were to take, let's say, the next 5 minutes and try to give us a synopsis of, you know, a guided tour of the universe in terms of how things are structured and all the various layers and realms and strata of creation, could you do that?
Yeah, only very quickly, really, because I think it's basically what the reality levels are reflections of our state of consciousness. So if we are identified with very physical pleasures and very physical aspects of ourselves, we attract on the next level when we die the same sort of circumstances, you know, like pubs and clubs and whatever.
Do we create that, or do we go to a realm where that's the way it is?
That's already there because it has been a collective construction,
yeah,
you know, over generations. And the thing is, it is just as physical as this one. So people who have out-of-body experiences, they sometimes think they travel to another place in the physical reality, you know. And I wrote an article in a journal or a new book explaining why that is not the case or cannot be the case. You know, so you have an out-of-body experience, you see buses and trains and taxis and pubs and people going shopping, and your instant reaction is, okay, these are just another part of the world, you know, and closer inspection you find that is not the case. It's basically the thought forms, the collective thought forms we created, the copy of what actually we experience in everyday life.
So they're kind of like astral buses and taxis and trains.
Yes, that's so right.
Do they burn astral gasoline and need astral motor oil and so on?
That was a question I kept asking myself. You know, for example, I've written about this in my book. I was at a printing plant. There was a printer I knew who had died. And he was still operating the printing plant, and I was very curious, and I opened one of the lids to the engines and see, well, if it's a thought world, then it doesn't have any insides. It's just sort of generated print simply by the power of thoughts. But when I opened it, there was all the engine, the mechanism was all inside. And I tried to find some sort of explanation, and I figured that what reality is basically a universal database, and it comes into existence by expectation. You know, for example, if I in one episode I described that I saw a car which was out of the 20s, you know, and I said, oh, that feels really real, you know, let me go and have a look close up. And when I looked close up at the paintwork, I found there were these minute scratches you get when you polish a car. And I said, that's incredible. Who could have thought about that? You know, how is this possible? You know, who is behind all this? And I found my explanation was that once we have a picture, we simply assemble, or the reality level assembles it from a database which is already in existence, you know. So it's basically like a hard drive, you know, where all the data are formed, and then when you look at it, it appears on the screen as a complete picture, you know. And this is something that really needs to be investigated, and I believe that latest models about the holographic universe and that, you know, the observer effect and all these sort of things. I don't know much about the quantum mechanics of it, but this is very much an understanding we are arriving at, that the universe is not really in existence, it's just made out of atoms or energy, and the moment we look at it, we assemble it in our brain and complete it. And these mechanics seem to be in existence, and they are responsible of our experience of what we see.
There's a kind of a collective agreement on what we experience. You know, as you're driving down the highway and there's all these other cars, everyone is seeing basically the same highway, although their perception may differ, and they all stop at the same stoplights and things like that. So there's something more than just complete individual consciousness creating the world. Otherwise, we'd have total chaos.
Yes, that's one thing which Robert Wagner, he wrote the book Lucid Dreaming, Key to Secret to the Inner Self or something, I think. He's a very, very good author, and he wrote another book. But he said, we don't control the sea, you know, when we dream, you know. We see a section of the sea, we can influence it, but this dream scenario we can't control. We can control aspects of our dreams, aspects of the reality, you know. And there are so many multiple levels to this reality. There's the individual aspect which we generate from our subconscious. And even that seems to have a solidity which is difficult to ignore. You know, but then there are other aspects, which is a consensus reality, which we enter into during an out-of-body state, where we meet other people, where I can talk to my relatives, you know, and they live in an environment which is agreed upon, which is just as solid as this one, and which is even harder to change than we are able to change the physical environment, because it has been solidified by the focus and the attention of generations of people, you know. So my eldest daughter, she went through a period where she could had out-of-body experience, and I asked her to do a test, and I said, can you change the environment next time you have an out-of-body experience? See if you can change the environment. And she came back, she said she found, I think it was a fountain, and she tried to change it, and she succeeded. But as soon as her attention was withdrawn, it changed back to how it was before, you know. So there is this consensus reality which feels very, very physical to the people who live there, which they are just as exposed to as we are on this level, you know.
Okay, but so about 5 or 10 minutes ago, I asked you about, all right, if you were to map out the whole range of creation, and we've been talking about what probably is a fairly preliminary level of creation, you know, the place that people commonly go when they die. And they have this consensus reality there. But there must be many, 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 many more and higher, if we want to use the word higher, strata.
Yes,
so can you kind of just quickly map out some of that?
Yes, the thing is, of course, as your consciousness becomes more elevated, your experiences become more positive, you get into more elevated, beautiful realms, which are also much more pliable, you know, much more less rigid, and for example, and more, much more beautiful, and your consciousness, your awareness sort of expands out, you know, you become more linked to what you see. You get more of a rapport with your environment. On the very, on the highest of the lower dimensions, you will get into a state of incredible fluid synchronicity.
Now we're going to, one thing we're going to do is perhaps paste in some of your paintings in this interview, and maybe this would be a good point to show some as we're talking. You know, just as kind of, I think by your own admission, you feel that they're pretty poor representations of what is actually there, but you know, doing the best you can with paint to give people an idea of it.
Yes, I try to use pictures because that's a natural medium for me to get some sort of representation of these realities. One thing which becomes increasingly clear as you get in out of the very basic physical type levels, it becomes much more dynamic. The reality, you know, you become aware of many more colors. On the basic level, everything is sort of represented very much like the physical world. The people look the same. As you move higher to more elevated levels, you find that the people become more attractive, more beautiful. The nature becomes more beautiful, more profuse. You get more vibrant colors. You get more harmonics in nature, you know. The interesting thing is how the environment reflects back on how you feel. You get into environments which evoke feelings in you, which you just simply cannot experience in the physical body. You know, for example, you could have a melancholic happiness, if you want, for want of a better word, you know. And that is expressed in the environment as a sort of lilac-y purple mist or atmosphere with a strange river flowing through which forks off into the distance, and you get a feeling of a completely new experience of something you have never experienced before. So this new type of experience, they increase as you get into higher states of consciousness. Everything unfolds, becomes more luminous, becomes richer, and your connection to this world becomes more intense and more, you feel more at home. That's one thing which is very powerful. The higher you go through the levels, if you like, the more you feel at home. There's a feeling of coming home. And this feeling of homecoming intensifies and is a good marker of how close you are to your core consciousness, you know, to the unity consciousness, if you like.
Are these higher realms populated by a variety of species, just the way the Earth is, or are there birds and other kinds of animals and whatnot, as well as human-type beings?
Yes, absolutely. I would say there are even a much greater variety of species. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost as if it trickles down, and on the way down to the physical level, it sort of is narrowed down, you know, and there's less variety. So I drew a picture of a multidimensional model where you increasingly find that there's a counterpart to the physical realm, there's a counterpart on a higher dimensional level, which is much bigger, if you like. You know, so there's a bigger Earth, there would be a bigger Jupiter or whatever. Maybe there will be additional moons which don't show up on the physical level. And on the very highest level, there's an infinite variety. And the way I mapped out the multidimensional levels was that I found when I started off in my bedroom and had an out-of-body experience, I ended up in a copy of the bedroom. Mm. And then on the next level, the bedroom may disappear and there may be a different apartment, but it's beautifully furnished. But I still recognize it as my bedroom. And then on the next level, the house may have disappeared. There's just an orchard, but it still feels like my bedroom. There's a familiarity or an energetic imprint which still has got the original identity of what is about. So I could identify localities by the atmosphere.
So I don't know if this question makes sense, but in terms of what you just said, if right sitting right where you are in that room, if you were to go to higher and higher and higher levels, would you actually still be in the same place, but would you be kind of exploring subtler realms or subtler levels of that same place, which the more subtle you go, bear less and less resemblance to the gross physical place in which you're now sitting?
Yeah, that's right. So they may actually totally disappear. And I experience and test it on different levels, you know, where there was, for example, a pub on a place that suddenly became a shop on the next day, and then it was part of a park. But I went to Hamburg. I had a lot of positive memories with Hamburg when I went to art school there. And I visited the astral counterpart there of the art school because I used to hang around there. And on one level, I was coming out of the art school and outside the art school, there's a little lake or a kind of river feeding a lake. And that lake suddenly was much bigger. And the benches went there, they were sort of monoliths. And the art school had changed, but I still recognized, I still identified it, you know. And so this gave me the idea that we live in a multidimensional universe where every atom has got a counterpart or has got an origin on a higher level or in pure consciousness, and it filters down and it manifests in different shapes and different ways without losing its original identity, if you like. So every object has a soul, you know.
And so on that note, if sometimes I interrupt with a question, I'm going to ask you more questions now, but if I ask one and you really want to finish saying what you're saying, let me know, because I don't want to leave out something important. But you were talking about Jupiter, for instance, a minute ago, and you know, ordinarily we think, all right, the Earth is the only planet in this solar system where there can be life. Everything else is too inhospitable to life. So there can be no life on the Sun, for instance, or on Mercury or on Venus. But if you go to subtler levels, do you find that those places are actually teeming with life?
Yes, I can only talk from the experiences which I made, and one of the planets I visited was Venus, and I found Venus was actually populated and had a very highly evolved civilization there. You know, I know it sounds nuts, and
on the gross level it's 800 or 900 degrees, so you couldn't live there. But on the subtle level,
it's habitable, mm-hmm. You know, and it is actually inhabited. And I try not to sort of go into these areas because when I first had these experiences, people sort of say, oh yeah, here's your new sort of on Mars again, you know. So I keep quite strong about it. But also in my latest book, I was quite bold about this because I have reported some instances where I had previous lives on different civilizations, different planets, describing their technology and everything, you know. And also in one of the experiences, I was taken away by an alien species.
I started reading that bit. You're on like a flying carpet or something that went to many times the speed of light to a different place.
Yes, that's right. And that was a very fascinating experience because that demonstrated two things to me, that there is other intelligent life, which may not even manifest on a physical planet, on a physical ground. And also they've got totally different civilizations and different ways of procreation and things like that. And I was sort of invited on this journey with these species. And I tried to be as authentic and as accurate as I was capable of. And I, all along the way, I wondered, can I actually write that without being, you know, told that I'm imagining it or it's a fantasy? And people say, oh yes, he is a fantasy illustrator, he made it all up. Yeah. But it has just the same, it has had just the same reality as I'm living here in the physical world, the same tangibility and the same waking awareness with which I observed it, you know, as everything else.
I have a question about that incident. I don't know if you can answer this, but according to Einstein, you know, if we were to travel that fast, then relativistic time dilation would come in, you know, Einstein's twins paradox. And if we came back from such a trip, we would find that everything around us had, you know, many years had gone by, whereas for us, it might have just been a short amount of time. Did you consider that in light of that experience?
I see things. I'm not a very scientifically minded person. I'm more of an artist, you know.
Okay.
But the way I see is a time, for example, which has also been hinted at, for example, karma and reincarnation, all these issues, I can explain it from my own experience, that we have, we can travel back in time. I have been able to travel into the future, but not in the same tangible way I've traveled into the past or visited a past life. I've written about it briefly in my book, The 10-Minute Moment. But
maybe the future is still, you know, to be determined, or, you know.
Yes, it's there are so many factors which is unrolling in the same way as a plant grows. You know, if you put a bit of acid on the plant, it will not grow, or something like that, you know. So that's basically a growth process, whereas the past is already the, you know, you can visit, and you can actually visit in such a way that you are there, you know.
Well, one issue that science fiction writers have dealt with a lot is, if you can go to the past, can you change anything there? And if you change things, what's that going to do to the present? I mean, do you have much volition when you go to these past?
No, it doesn't happen on a physical level. It happens on a memory level. And the best way I can describe it was from my own experience, that I went into a past life, and it started off that I was walking through a mud. And as I looked down on my body, I found that my clothes were quite different to what they are now. And I noticed I was, I had a sword, and I had armor, and a very coarsely knitted coat. And I identified it as a medieval type of character I was. And as I was trudging through the mud, I suddenly became privy of the experiences this person had and the mind content. So at that moment, there were two of me. There was the observer and the person experiencing it, okay? And I was totally involved in the experience the person had, but I was also conscious that I was lying in bed, and there was an observer part of me. So there were three aspects of me. There was the observer, the person who had the experience, and the physical body which was lying in bed. And all the time I was walking along with him, there was no way I could influence him. Mm. He was totally oblivious of me.
So let's say that happened 500 years ago, and you were walking along through the mud there. And do you think that, from that guy's perspective, if he had been aware of it, if he had been capable of being aware of it, he would have realized, whoa, some being from the future, hey, it's me, is watching me walk along through the mud here. I mean, was there actually that kind of dynamic going on?
My feeling was, when I was this guy, there was no possibility of me being aware of.
Well, no, he wasn't aware of it. But 500 years ago, as that guy was walking through the mud, were you actually there checking him out? You know, on some subtle
yes.
level, which somebody, if he had been capable, or someone else had been capable of experiencing it, they would have actually observed.
But it felt so physical. There was no doubt about it in my mind that I wasn't experiencing it as him. It was a real life present experiencing. You know, it was almost as if I had been transported back in time, and that was a present awareness. There was no getting away from it. And that was not the only occasion. I had several other occasions where I was transported back in time in a different life, in a different body. And one stage I was on a council in an Peruvian empire, you know, where we were just debating whether we should allow the savages to come into the town or whether we should keep them at arm's length. And then it was decided that the savages were quite useful to the townspeople because they would make cheap labor. And in order to discriminate them, they would be dressed in trousers, which was not a kind of clothing which the townspeople would wear, you know. And I experienced a whole episode in one go, and I was not sure that was a wise idea. And what happened gradually, these people became very unhappy being treated the way they were. And soon enough, they found weaknesses in the fortification, and then the whole empire went to pieces when the others heard about it and so on. So I had this whole episode unrolling in front of me, but at the same time, at each moment, I was aware of sitting there in the flesh, aware of the clothes I wore, the dialogue going on between us, the animosity and the tension that felt just as real as it would if I sit in a boardroom meeting on the physical planet and discussing it, you know. So that to me, that is sort of Akashic, the reality of the Akashic records is an actual experience. It's not a vision. It's not something which we think about, but it's an actual experience. And that can be experienced during out-of-body states, you know, of consciousness.
So a few minutes ago, we were talking about all these different levels, and you were saying that the higher you go, the more beautiful it gets, and the more malleable it is, the less rigid or calcified or, you know, things are. Do you get to a point as you go higher and higher where the dwellers of that realm are dwelling there more or less eternally and are not going to have to come back to the human realm? That's a sort of a permanent abode, or are all these places just sort of, you know, temporary abodes which we'll eventually have to shift out of and experience other things?
Well, the experience I had of as you get into higher levels, there comes a stage where your self-identification somehow has to be surrendered, you know, your ego identification. And that is a point where you then enter into a much higher state of a type of spiritual consciousness. And then things really become very interesting because your awareness is no longer limited by an identification. You're much more in a state of fluid consciousness, you know.
But there must be some, I don't know if we call it identification, some sort of sense of this is me and this is you and this is him. Because otherwise, if it's just totally amorphous.
But there's still a sense of individuality, uh-huh. Very much so.
But not at all predominant or limiting.
No, I mean, there's still people who are discrete
and distinct.
Yeah, and representing themselves in the same way as we do. But in a much more creative way, if you like, or more inventive way, and because they've got more options at their disposal. You know, for example, the clothes you wear, they may change to the kinds of thoughts you have, you know. and the buildings you occupy, they're usually a very close representations of what you are like, you know, the person you are like, but in a higher evolved state, so they're very symmetric, very beautiful, you know, but you can immediately see if you come to a certain building, what kind of person inhabits it. You get the whole atmosphere, the whole imprint, and there's an affinity between the individuals, so you can have an instant communication just by looking at their building, and you then inhabit their thoughts instantly, you know, and there's no objection, no division, there's always a friendly, positive vibration, because on these levels there just simply is no negativity, you know, everything is thinking in a harmonious interplay, which is very fluid and very beautiful and always enhancing, you know, this is aspect of enhancement, that of positivity.
And Maharshi used to refer to the ground state of creation as the field of all possibilities. And, you know, because nothing has manifested yet, so anything can manifest.
Yes.
And then the more things manifest, the more kind of limited it becomes. And physics actually has corresponding understanding that, you know, the vacuum state or the unified field is contains all potential manifest states, but that once manifestation proceeds, then greater and greater rigidity prevails the more manifest things become.
Yes, that's very much the case. I also found on the higher levels, there's this trickle-down effect. For example, you see another very important aspect is thought forms, unmanifested thoughts, of thoughts which have an abstract quality to themselves. So these thoughts create abstract shapes, which are very beautiful to behold, but they express perfectly the quintessence of that thought simply by looking at it, the structure, and listening to the sound they give off, and the animation. So you instantly apprehend the thought in its entirety, and that can be a whole ideology manifested in a shape, and, you know, almost like a big city or something.
I was supposed to interview David Spangler last week, who was one of the founders of Findhorn, but he had a health crisis, and hopefully we'll reschedule him soon. But he said that when he went to high school and started studying geometry, he went deep into it, and he discovered that the various forms in geometry actually have an archetypical intelligence fundamental to them. And you know, he found that incredibly fascinating, that they're not just sort of inanimate forms, but they're kind of surface representations of deeper impulses of intelligence that structure or govern the universe.
Yes, that's one of the key things which I found, that there is no such thing as inanimate matter. Everything is intelligent driven.
Yes,
you know, and there's no exception to it, and it's just incredible. I mean, I once posed the question while I was there, you know, what is the ego, you know, and how does the ego come about, and why do we have an ego? And suddenly, when you have these questions on these dimensional levels, you don't just get an answer, you get a multimedia slideshow, you know, and it has got sound and everything. And I suddenly was confronted with an infinite web of a tapestry, where each aspect of the tapestry led into the neighboring part, and it created a beautiful carpet, or an infinite carpet. And as I honed in at each ornament, if you like, which formed one pattern of the whole web, I found from that viewpoint, everything spread out, the whole universe unfolded around it. So the person who was at the center of each one of these, let's say, crystals or snowflake crystals, you know, which was the one aspect of this infinite pattern, they saw their universe coming expanding from their cell out into the open. And I suddenly had a clear picture. This is how every person sort of perceives themselves. Every person can consider themselves quite rightly the center of the universe, because that is their experience. When they look out from their standpoint, they see everything spreading out from them, their friends and everything. They are individual and they are unique, you know. There's no doubt about this, and they're the most important person in the world. Mm-hmm. And all the things around them, they identify it, and they build their self-identity from these information they feed from around them. And so they establish an ego identification, you know, because they see themselves as the center of the universe. And that doesn't only apply to human beings. That applies to every plant, every animal, every ant, every atom in the universe. Everything.
Some spiritual teachers use the phrase "life without a center." Jeff Foster uses that, and others. In your experience, if the ego has been seen through, is there a sense that, you know, life doesn't have a center?
Oh yeah, I mean, what is happening is, I try as much as possible only talk of what I have experienced, you know. And I have in one of the descriptions in my latest book, Business of Infinity, I had an experience where I saw myself as a expanded pattern, just the way I described it. But this pattern was not just two-dimensional, it was a three- or four-dimensional thing which contained lives on other planets. I could zoom into each aspect of these patterns which I was made of, and I could easily see the relationship to my core self-awareness or my my core being awareness, you know. And the history that was created, I could see the weak points, I could see the strong points, I could see how it connected in the past to other patterns and so on. The whole thing for me was visible simply because I had a kind of more elevated viewpoint as a being, from a being state. Mm. I was not necessarily identified with it, you know, but there was still a strong connection as an individual. Whereas my self-awareness was shifted onto a more universal level. But there was still an appreciation of this individual aspect which I had been nurturing, you know.
When you were a student and much younger, did you go through a psychedelic phase?
Yes, I mean, when I was very young, I mean, in my early 20s, before...
Did you have pretty far-out experiences with that?
Yeah. And LSD was still legal, let's say.
Yeah.
We went through a stage which lasted about 6 months or so, where every month we would read Aldous Huxley. Mm-hmm. And we would experiment. We didn't see ourselves as drug heads.
No, you have pretty amazing experiences as a non-drug using person, you know, meditating and OBE and all that. Back when you were using drugs, were you the envy of your friends in terms of how amazing your experiences were?
I sometimes was surprised that they didn't see what I saw. Mm. You know, I mean, I on some of these drug experiences, I could see through the ground, yeah. You know, I had telescopic visions and things. I just took it in my stride, but you also had these revelations, you know, of a newness of awareness and all these sort of things. Of course, these kind of experience have very much manifested now, I find, you know, but they are more a kind of everyday experience. For example, when I go out of the house to get milk, you know, to the shop, which I've done hundreds of times, I always consider this to be a unique and new experience.
Right, there's a freshness.
Yes, there's no familiarity as such.
Yeah, well, you know how to find the store, but there's not the sort of habituated way of perceiving the world, right? I mean, there's an innocence and a freshness.
Yes, yes. Everything is a first. You know, it's new. Yeah. It's an experience. So you don't fall into the pattern of referring to what you have learned or what you've known and made it into a cliche.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of ability or disability has sort of been stripped away, and instead you see things fresh.
Yeah.
You know, conditioned.
Sure.
So
I mean,
so
there's some conditioning is useful. You don't have to learn how to drive a car every day or how to brush your teeth or something, but I think that there's a difference between that kind of conditioning or learning and any sort of habituation that has taken place, that takes place through, you know, repeatedly being identified or overshadowed by experience.
Mm. Yeah, I think, I mean, even brushing your teeth is a new experience. You know, there's a aspect which somehow strings all this together in an automatic way, which we rely on a part of our nervous system, which is actually programmed to make sense, you know, to, it's another aspect of ourselves which we allow to control the control of the learning and things. You know, for example, when I write, do some illustrations, I rely on the fact that I know how to use the tools.
Yeah.
So, and that doesn't disappear, you know. But at the same time, you can actually have a new input during this process. You know, if you walk along to the store instead of thinking, oh yes, I know that, you know, you don't look at it like that. I had a funny experience when I went to Hamburg in the summer. We went over to the Baltic Sea and we were looking at the sunset, you know, and one person, he was wandering off. He said, Herbert, come here, look at the sunset. He said, no, I've seen it before.
That's funny.
So you know, so it's, this sort of thing doesn't apply anymore because you see things with fresh eyes, and that is what makes life so enjoyable.
Yeah,
it's not only that, but because there is the absence of fear or the absence of alienation, because you recognize what you're experiencing is all part of who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, the alienation has been taken out of your life, and suddenly you're always on familiar ground, so to speak. You know, the way I describe it sometimes is the world becomes an extension of your living room.
Nice.
You know, you feel it's familiar ground. There's no otherness in a sense.
Yeah.
And that makes it really enjoyable.
There's a Sanskrit saying that goes something like Vasudev Tukumbakam, which means the world is my family.
Mm. Yes, it's this familiarity which is so beautiful. And I think in this is rooted the spiritual ideal that we're all a family, that we all belong together. You know,
there's an interesting paradox here, because a minute ago you were saying, well, everything is fresh and unique and like it's the very first time. And on the other on the other hand, there's this familiarity. The world is my family. And so that's an interesting juxtaposition.
Yes, I think that is fed from the fact that we realize the essence,
right,
of, but the essence in everything is also reinventing itself. It's always refreshed from the inside. The energy is poured out. So nothing is ever static. So we're picking up on the core aspect of the essence of this energy, and of course within it is a bliss aspect. You
bliss,
know?
Right.
So not only do we see the beauty of it, but while we're observing the beauty, there's also a blissful experience associated to it.
Nice.
So I always look at things as the world is basically bliss covered in appearance. So at various points as you walk through the world, you pierce the world and the bliss pours out.
Nice.
The bliss is always there, and you cannot really escape it. You just have to pop it out, let it pop out. And you can do that by observing somebody smiling in the supermarket, you know, or a conversation, and you say, oh, that's really beautiful, you know, and suddenly you see the bliss underneath it. This makes this togetherness sort of come about. And the surface is peeled away from the world, you know, and you see what's underneath it, the beauty that carries it, or the eternal beauty that has no destruction associated to it.
Here's a question, a couple of people sent in questions. Here's one from Catherine in Liverpool. She asked, and this relates to what you're just saying, I think, have you ever seen anything appear in this dimension from another? And I mean, I'm not sure exactly what she had in mind when she asked the question, but we might say that that bliss you were just describing belongs to another dimension, and yet you're saying that it becomes characteristic of this so-called dimension all the time.
Yes, I mean, this is basically, that's the experience I mostly have, but I think she may be referring to ghosts or people.
Or an angel showing up, or maybe she's thinking of that kind of thing.
Yes, I haven't personally experienced entities, because what I see is basically physical matter in its primary condition, you know, in its primary state. I'm a very practical, sort of down to earth, reality focused person, you know, and I somehow. I'm only really clairvoyant when I'm out of my body.
That's interesting. I mean, I know people who are sort of clairvoyant in their body, so to speak. In other words, they see angels and subtle beings all the time as they walk through the supermarket or, you know, do anything. But in your case, it seems like you have to kind of go there to see them, and when you're here, you don't see them.
No, that's right. I mean, I'm quite sort of coarse kind of person, you know, rooted in this physical reality.
Oh, yeah, you're a regular British soccer fan.
Yes, it's right. So, no, that's very much the case. But when I'm out of my body, I become highly clairvoyant, you know.
Do you feel like a desire or any movement in the direction of integrating it such that you would be perceiving these other realms while you were functioning in this realm?
I have no interest in really, and it sounds absurd on the basis of what we just discussed. I have no interest really in out of body experiences, because I find this reality offers so much content and beauty and fullness that I have no desire to reproduce it on another level or so. You know, the attraction has almost faded. The only time I have out-of-body experiences now is, for example, when a close relative dies, a friend, or if there's a strong motivation, or if there is a call from a greater perspective to me to learn something. But as far as I'm concerned, it is really basically not necessary to have out-of-body experiences.
Yes, and so in your case, done that, been there, as they say.
Yes, it's more, I'm addicted to reality, basically. I really enjoy being where I am and embracing it, you know, even if it's sometimes painful, you know. So that's where I'm at the moment. I don't know what's going to happen, whether there is a need for me to do further exploration. With my latest book, I did feel there was a need for education, but I since found out that only a handful of people are interested. So it's not going to be become by knowledge. You know, that was a hope that people, the millions of people who are stranded on the lower levels, that they get a preview of what they can do in order to move fast through the lower levels and get a much more enjoyable life out of the after.
Yeah.
That was one of the things really that I intended writing it.
Here's a question from my wife, Irene. She says, in Hindu scriptures, there's a mention of lokas or spheres or sometimes it's, I think they mean realms, or even they sometimes refer to them as worlds, various lokas, like, you know, Krishna loka and whatever. Does Jürgen feel that this relates to his travels in any way?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different realms which are created by a consensus, a preference of people, you know, where they gyrate around a certain, like a certain town, which has got certain distinct characteristics. There are tourist centers, which I described in my book, you know, but they are also quite, they're quite beautiful thought worlds or realms where people are interested in a certain subject and expand it into a complete world or universe, you know, which may have even quite a tangible characteristic in color. It may be like a bluish tint world, you know, where you can feel there's a certain consensus, a certain interest, and there are an infinite variety of these types of locals. The same applies on a negative level.
Sure, right? Yeah.
Very negative centers.
Jesus said, in my Father's house there are many mansions. I believe that's the quote.
Yes,
you know, just
yes,
all these different affinity groups, you could say. You know,
if
you have a certain quality or characteristic that you've brought, you know, that you've kind of like reinforced in your life, then you will, birds of a feather flock together, you'll
yes,
find your affinity group.
And I think that's where you feed from, you know, if you're an artist and you are interested in modern or in cubism, you know, you're probably connect to the cubist sort of city on the islands.
That'd be a weird place
to get your inspiration from there. If you're in certain types of music, you know, you will probably feed from these thought forms on higher energy levels, you know, be enriched by them.
Here's a question from Mark in Santa Clara, California. He asks, do you have any intuition as to what binds the consciousness to a particular body? Does some bodily identification have to remain for a particular incarnation to remain coherent?
Yeah, I think what keeps people fixated, you know, in certain conditions is basically they haven't dealt with their fixations properly. Is that what he means?
What he means is, well, the second part of his question makes more sense to me than the first part, and Mark is welcome to send in a clarification, but does some bodily identification have to remain for a particular incarnation to remain coherent? In other words, if you had no bodily identification whatsoever, how could you live? You know, you would need to, how would you dress? How would you eat? How would you prevent yourself from walking into walls? There needs to be some sense that, oh, this is a body.
Yeah,
I need to take care of this body. I need to feed it. I don't want to put my hand on the stove and things like that. You know?
Yes, I think this. There's an inner program. There's a physical program, there's the emotional program, there's the intuitive program, and all these things create the organism, which we call human. You know, the only difference is if you are fully aware, you're not identified with this aspect exclusively. You only see it as an aspect of the whole of who you are, you know, and you will nurture it, you will look after it, you will do the best to make it work properly. So you take advantage of all the functions which are inherent in the structure, the biological structure of the body, and the mental and emotional structure, and you make sure it runs properly. So there's no way you can run into a wall or something just because you've got your consciousness is expanded and encompasses more rather than the physical, you know, and the physical mechanism.
Yeah.
So you have got an additional quality of a higher expanded awareness where you see your physical entity as an apparatus which you maintain to the best of your ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So we've been going on for quite a while, and there are so many interesting things in your book, in your books, and I think that, you know, perhaps we could conclude by, I mean, it seems like your current emphasis has left behind a lot of the things that fascinated you when you were younger, like you were just saying OBEs don't excite you that much anymore. And here's a quote from your book where you say, meditation can take you far beyond any out-of-body state and be far more rewarding. Meditation can teach you that you are consciousness and everything else is an image, little more than a projection or an illusion. In our physical life, we only see the tip of the iceberg. Our greater reality is an awe-inspiringly immense, magnificent. In comparison to what our true potentials are as a species, we are little more than slugworms rising from the mud. and here you say, at the moment, I am interested in the mechanics of the higher states of consciousness beyond the out-of-body state. So it seems like you've kind of, you know, OBEs were a tool for you, and you've pretty much relinquished them. And, you know, and since most people aren't going to have the facility for OBEs that you have had, I've never had, well, I don't think I've ever had one. I've had a couple little things, but nothing much, even though I've been meditating for 48 years. What advice would you give spiritual seekers in general? Would you advise them to meditate? If so, how? Would you encourage them to explore out-of-body experiences or astral travel or any of that stuff? I mean, you know, somebody just kind of starting out or maybe who's been interested in this stuff for a while but feels like they have not really gotten too far yet, what direction would you point them in?
Well, I personally am a firm believer in reality as it presents us, you know, as it's presented to us. And I feel that the crux of meditation is to become aware and embrace what is, you know, rather than, I mean, what you said earlier, to a certain extent is true. Why do we want to, you know, seek something for its own sake, unless it's part of our path, you know, unless it's given to us. And there's a clear mandate that this is the way we should explore our individuality or our life and find our way to the greater consciousness. I think the paths are as infinite as people are, so everybody has to find their own way. But to me, the most primary, the thing of most importance is to find my way to the being state of how it presents itself at this moment, and not exclude anything. But to me, meditation means to say, to accept what is, and warts and all, you know, and to find the inner aspect of what presents itself and find a relationship to this inner aspect, you know, and that can, and that I feel is the only way we can overcome all the different hardships and problems we have created for ourselves, to find the essence of the reality of how it presents itself and relate to it rather than see it as part of ourselves rather than pushing it to one side and saying, oh, that's not for me, that's not my problem, you know. And that's very much the way I see it. And all through my life, I always welcomed the idea of being shown the reality, you know, of things, because I always felt it brings me closer to the truth, you know, if I'm able to embrace reality rather than reject it. Mm. And I still feel like that.
Here's a question from Dan in London. He says, do you feel that there are different consensus realities on higher levels that are associated with different religions, such as a reality associated with the teachings of Jesus or a different one with Krishna? And I might add to this question and ask, are some consensus realities closer to the truth than others?
Yeah, that's a big question, really. I have a lot of arguments with or discussions with people, my personal feeling is that the moment we create an ideology or religion, we sort of tend to remove ourselves from the original blank sheet, or the pure, the clarity aspect, which I find will always fail to be dressed in adequate words or a philosophy. There may be people who take this, there may be philosophies or religions who take this into account and say, okay, we have got this belief, but in the end, it comes down to the experience of the reality which supersedes what our philosophy is all about. But rarely religions rarely do that. They always want to put themselves into the center of a world picture, a world view, because people have the natural tendency to want to be identified with something. You know, they want to have an identity. So, because the only way you can transcend it is by getting into a state of unity consciousness, a much greater identity, which is clarity, you know, which supersedes everything. And then you don't have any problems, or you don't make any assumptions that one thing is bigger or better than another thing. You know, you just see things the way they are. And then you don't have any desire to create a philosophy out of it, because in the end, you know very well, it boils down to your own experience.
Yeah. We better wrap it up pretty soon, because it's getting dark over there. We're going to be sitting in the dark pretty soon. So maybe here's an interesting wrap-up topic, and I'll let you riff on this a little bit. And that is that in one of your books, I was reading about some experiences you had which gave you a vision of the future, what the future of humanity might be. Maybe you could just give us a glimpse of your sense of that, and you know how, maybe at the same time, how certain you feel it is, or whether it's just one possibility and it could really go the other way if we don't play our cards right.
Yes, I think my this was an experience I had on the morning of my retreat, on one of the mornings when I suddenly had a clear impression of what our future may actually be, and I saw it in a very, very positive way unfolding, you know, and I saw that the technology we are already creating is going to largely help us out of the sinkhole, you know, and there are things which are in progress at the moment which will make it possible to create energy which is not dependent on massive installations, but energy which can be local. Now, that is something that is already in existence, but my view of it, or the picture that I've been confronted with, and it was not in a sense like an out-of-body experience where I was physically there. It was more a knowingness, you know, which I could access. And that was pointed to a very bright, positive future, you know, which was, it came in two parts. One was perhaps within the next 100 years, that society was completely changed because the parameters have changed, the awareness has changed, and we are just at the beginning of such a change. As you have mentioned several times in your talks, there's an awakening taking place where we become more cognizant of our real identity. And this sort of awareness will be rolled out in much the same way as the awareness that the Earth is a globe was rolled out over the decades, and at some point it will actually be taken for granted. And then the mindset will change, and people will harness their intellect and their knowledge to make bring the community sense of our species more into the fore and make us more a better functioning civilization. And that was a very strong picture which I feel very positive about, you know, that these things are happening. I didn't see at any stage a destruction or a global catastrophe at all.
That's good. So you don't think that things are going to get worse before they get better, and that global warming might kill billions of people or some such thing? You think that it's just going to, and obviously you don't think Donald Trump will be elected president, but you think things are just going to kind of get...
I have to say, I can't be sure. I can't be sure because, especially with people like Donald Trump, he seems to be personifying the ultimate ego, you know. It may just be that we need to be confronted with an external representation of our ego before we actually see the light.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be the case. The philosophy is make Donald Trump great again, so we can see, so we can see our ego, you know, more clearly. Who knows what way we try to find in order to see the light? I have no idea. It's the thing. The danger is by making any predictions of any sort that we become complacent and then say, "Oh well, everything is going to be fine." I don't think it is the case. You know, as I said earlier in a metaphor, you know, if the plant grows and we pour acid on it, it may quickly die, you know. So that applies everything we do. You know, we have got to be vigilant, we have to be alert, we have to nurture the growth in a very careful, positive way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So
predictions aren't certainties, they're possibilities.
Yes, that's how I would say it is.
All right. Well, great. There's so many more things we could talk about, but we're entering into record interview length territory at this point. We should probably wrap it up. So thank you so much for this conversation. I've really appreciated it and appreciated getting to know you a little bit. Very kind of, I like these sort of visions of possibilities kinds of discussions, you know, as opposed to people who are saying, well, it's only this and blah. But it's like, yes, but it's this and, you know. So I really appreciate your perspective in that way. And it's obviously based in experience. You're not just sitting there philosophizing and speculating.
No.
It's good.
Try to stay away from that, you know. It's got to be have it grown somewhere.
Yeah. So as always, I'll be creating a page on BatGap for this interview and, you know, putting some biographical information, links to your website, links to your books, anything else that you've asked me to link to. So people who are listening to this can go to that and follow those links. So thank you very much, Jürgen, and thanks to those who have been listening or watching. And you know, the usual things I say at the end about check out the website and all the different menus and, you know, past interviews, future interviews, donate button, all that. Yeah, I've said it many times, so you know how to do that. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you all next time.
Thanks, Rick.
You're very welcome. Good. So let me just stop the recording here.